Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on the web, 989fm.com.au or on our podcast a bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company on a beautiful day here in Brisbane, and I hope the weather is good wherever you are. Today we're going up to the top, a beautiful part of the country, the Torres Strait. We're going to find out what's happening up there because we don't often hear about that region of the world. And joining us on the program to tell us and give us a bit of an update is the editor of the Torres News, Aaron Smith. Aaron, how are you this morning?
Yeah, good, thanks. It's a lovely sunny day up here as well, unseasonably so.
I can imagine it's always like that up there in paradise.
Look, it's meant to be raining right now, but we're being clobbered by El Nino pretty hard and we haven't had the wet.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so you're actually waiting for it this time around.
Yeah, well, the wet should just about be over by now, but it never really came.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
We've had a few days here and there, but 90% of the rain we expected hasn't turned up.
Oh, that's a bit of a shame.
Yeah, it's a bit scary. Some of those outer island communities are really feeling the pinch. And
they're really feeling it.
Because the road is, suffering pretty hard as well.
That's, it's not really, you wouldn't expect it. The stereotype of a tropical island or a tropical paradise is that you get a lot of rain and that, you would never have to worry about these sort of almost like drought-like conditions, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the worst El Nino we've had on record and now we've just gone through globally the hottest February on the record since records were taken in 1880. So it's looking pretty like it's going to be a hot year, and it's certainly a lot warmer and drier than it probably should be.
Well, hopefully we can talk about that later in the program. I wanted to actually start by asking you about your history because we haven't had you on for a while. A lot of our listeners probably wouldn't be as accustomed to it because you're actually from Tasmania, a completely different island, far removed from Torres Strait, aren't you?
Yeah, one island to the next. I grew up in Tassie, but I spent a lot of time all around Australia, all around the world actually, but a lot of time in Melbourne and Sydney and then a lot of time overseas. That's where I started working as a journalist, as a travel writer. Lived in South America for 3 years. I've written a couple of books, travel adventure stories, and came back to Australia about 7 years ago and went back to uni, did my master's and became a journalist. And I've been up here for about three years now in the Torres Strait.
What do you think? What was the thing that surprised you most when you first went up to the Torres Strait?
Well, I think like most mainstream Australians, you know very little about it. I mean, the only thing I really knew about the Torres Strait was it was far north and that Eddie Mabo had come from here, and that was about it. And when I got the job, I basically had to hit Google and have a good look around about where I was moving to. Now living here for 3 years, you realise that there's a whole wealth of stories and culture and stuff here that most of Australia has absolutely no idea about. So it's been a pretty sharp learning curve and a pretty privileged journey along the route as well.
I can imagine there'd be a lot of ignorance about the Torres Strait because there's so, most Australians just wouldn't have an understanding of it. I mean, I think it's a place you probably have to live there to have a good understanding of it, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's part of Indigenous Australia, but it's much more Polynesian than it is mainstream Aboriginal in its sort of cultural influences. That said, it's a bit of a microcosm of multicultural Australia because it's got genetic mixes of Malay, Japanese, Chinese, Papuan, Melanesian, and Aboriginal, and now obviously European. So it's for a long time it's been working the multicultural mix is in sense of a lot of different cultures coming through the place. But that said, it also has its own very much unique Indigenous culture as well, which stems back, a very long time.
One of the interesting things, the local government elections in Queensland were held all throughout the state on the weekend. We haven't heard a lot about the Torres Strait, have we? But we could be facing, it's been reported on SBS that a lady called Vonda Malone is actually set to be the first female mayor of Torres Shire. That's quite historic, wouldn't it be?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's also historic is the end of the era of Pedro Stephen, who was the longest living Queensland mayor. He was the first Indigenous mayor.
Yeah,
and he was mayor of Torres Shire for over 20 years, and he'd almost become a permanent fixture in the political landscape up here. So it was quite a surprise to see a new political face come along. Vonda ran in the last election, and it was a close race then. So in some ways, we knew it was going to be a close race. She's had the numbers for a while, but I think culturally, it's going to be a completely different era. Vonda's very qualified and for the job. I think she's got a lot of experience and professional experience and qualifications behind her, and be interesting to see what this new era unfolds for us up here.
In relation to the Torres Strait, I mean, there's two local government bodies, two councils in the Torres Strait, isn't it? The Torres Shire, which is what Vonda Malone is most likely won, and also the Torres Strait Regional Council. Can you tell us a little bit about the background of those two councils?
Yeah, well, look, it's actually, in my readership, I've actually got three local councils, three local governments, two Indigenous councils, and one of the mainstream councils. So we've got the Torres Shire as the mainstream council, which is the same as any other council in Queensland, and then we've got two Indigenous councils, which run slightly differently. So that's the Northern Peninsula Area Regional Council, which is just the very tip of Cape York, with there's five Indigenous communities, and then there is the Torres Strait Island Regional Council, which is the 15 outer island communities of the Torres Strait. So that's sort of our lot up here, and the difference is the regular mainstream council, the Torres Shire Council, runs up a similar model of gaining rates off residents, whereas the regional Indigenous councils don't have that rate base because there's a lot of social housing and there just isn't the rate base to draw upon. So they are dependent more on state and federal funding to get their infrastructure works and maintenance programs running. So there's slightly different governance models in that respect. But look, it was quite an election. We had, over those three councils in our region, we had some 66 candidates, 11 mayoral candidates, to govern under 10,000 people, and we also had a federal peak body which has an influence in governing the region as well, the Torres Strait Regional Authority. So it is quite a complex web to get your head around of how governance occurs up here.
It's really interesting. I mean, what sort of issues do you think came into play when people actually went out to vote? And I assume the voting, they had to vote for two separate councils, or, you know, if you're in the Torres Strait, you're voting for two. In two elections, almost, is that how it works?
No. It's you're only voting for one council. It just depends where you live. So there's the inner islands of Prince of Wales, Horn, and Thursday Island voted for Torres Shire, which is the mainstream council, which is where the majority of the region's population is situated. And then there's 15 outer island communities which vote for their regional council. So you're only voting for one council. It just depends which area you live in, where you're registered to vote. And then there's the MPA, which votes for the M Park Council there. So it does seem like there's a lot of governance in the area, but it actually stems back to when they had there was even more councils. That they had the island councils.
Yeah,
right. Each island had its own council, and that was later amalgamated into the Torres Strait Regional Island Council, which is TCIRC, and Torres Shire. So Prior to the amalgamation, and also down the MPA, each of those five communities had their own council. So prior to the amalgamation, there was over 20 councils in the region.
Yeah, right, because I remember that was quite controversial when those amalgamations happened, making one big super shire, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, and there's still remnants of that controversy still affecting the electorate today. There's still gripes and concerns, probably more so in the Northern Peninsula area, where there's been concerns that the central community of Bamaga, which is now the HQ for the NPA has got too much power and is drawing things from the periphery to the centre, and there is some discontent about that, and calls for it to be stripped back down to the community councils. But I can't honestly see that happening, just because of managing infrastructure and stuff. But who knows? There's been pretty much a new face of government in all three of those local councils. Fred Geeler, the Torres Strait Regional Council, is the only mayor that's kept his seat,
yeah, right.
And he kept it quite firmly. Whereas the other two mayors have been unseated, and a lot of the councillors have also changed. So the people have spoken, and there's looks like there's a new face of all three governments in many ways. And yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, and if the personality of that council is going to be different to the previous. That said, there's only so much a local government can do. Their hands are tied to the funding that they get from the state, or the occasional funding from the feds. So you have to wonder what real change that can actually bring about, because they're obviously limited by state policy primarily.
And do you find that, I guess, when people are voting for their separate councils, I mean, when you talk about the inner islands and the outer islands, are they voting because of completely separate issues, different issues that affect them?
It's an interesting quagmire. I mean, like, we offered every councillor a free platform in the paper, so that was potentially 66 platforms we had to publish, and only 7 of them took it up. And that said, I've been told that there's been more interest in the paper for the election than previous years, but it seems to be a closed door affair between families, and there's not a great deal of public spruiking. I know that Vonna did a lot of door knocking, whereas traditionally it's sort of discussed very privately and in family meetings and about how the voting's going to go. Because obviously there's a lot of people are intermarried, interrelated in these communities, yeah. And so the lobbying is not what you'd expect. Like, there wasn't a great deal of, vote one for Pedro or Vonda signs getting around until the last few days, and even then there was probably only half a dozen on TI, and there wasn't a inundation of leaflets to vote for different people in the letterbox. It was, if you didn't know there was an election on, you'd be none the wiser. So it was pretty hard to gauge the sense of the community and how it was folding out. But it's my first local election up here, and it was a lot different to the state and federal one, where you obviously had a lot more canvassing of the community. But it was all sort of done by the Bush Telegraph, I think.
It's a completely different way of doing democracy, isn't it? You get a sense of just the different way Black Australia and White Australia votes.
Yeah, well, one interesting comment I had from one of the councillors on the Outer Island when I was working out there at one of the islands recently was that he was lamenting that the democratic process actually worked against them, because traditionally the system that they used to operate was a tribal system, where there was basically, by one means or another, there was a consensus who was the tribal leader of that island community, and then everyone stood behind that leader. But whereas some of these communities only have 150 voters on it, yep. or less. Like Ooga only has like 30 people living on it, and you've got two candidates. So that's going to really split the vote and also split the community. So you may if there's three candidates, like some of these islands have three or even four candidates for the local councillor, and so if you take, you could potentially win that seat with only a quarter of the votes. Or just over a quarter of the votes. And this particular councillor was lamenting that, so you win the seat in the local government, but the majority of the community may well be against you.
Yeah, right, which would be very hard to sort of negotiate, wouldn't it?
And then you've got to also liaise with your PBC, the traditional owners. So there can often be impasses with infrastructure development, because there's clashes of what people believe should be doing. And this particular councillor said he was elected unopposed. There was no one else, so there was no competition. But then he reckons the first year and a half just sort of negotiating with his community to understand what everyone wanted and to get that consensus, to get that sort of tribal leader consensus back into play. And
right.
uh, And so, yeah, look, there's often a lot of bitter infighting in these communities, a lot of impasses with developments and stuff. And I think it comes from, you know, the democratic system being imposed on the tribal system, and then trying to navigate a way through that, which is not necessarily smooth sailing.
And I can imagine it would be a lot tougher as well, because you're actually living in the community you're sort of representing as well. So you also have to live as a community member, which would be quite hard. I think it's a completely different burden that's placed on you than from a different politician, just a mainstream politician representing a mainstream electorate.
Yeah, well, it's like, it is a different, I mean, everybody knows everybody. So you know pretty much all the politicians on a first name basis, and, you know, and which is different to what you'd have anywhere else in any other community, where it's unlikely you'll ever meet most of the politicians that are representing you. So that has a big part to play, and especially when you hear sort of stories of, you know, corruption and wrongdoing. It's like you feel like the whole thing is corrupt, but actually it's just because you know everyone and you meet them at the supermarket, and, you know, you chat to them, and it's like, and then you hear all the small town banter about this, that, and the other, and it must be extremely hard to try and govern and make tough decisions under that environment. And but that said, I mean, there is a sort of an island way of doing things and interacting, where you may have a beef with someone, but you don't, you know, it's never exposed at the veggie stand at the supermarket or at the community functions. It's, you know, you sort of leave your axes at the door and get on with interacting in that community. And I mean, that said, there is a very, very strong, probably the strongest sense of community out of anywhere I've lived in Australia, if not possibly the world, up here in the Torres Strait. It's, you know, people rally together for various causes throughout the year and celebrate and mourn and so forth together. And so, yeah, it's an interesting way of living. I guess it's the only way of surviving on an island in a small community.
Yeah, very beautiful community feeling up there as well. I was interested in the last edition, I think it came out March 14th of the Torres News. You were talking about federal funding and state funding and sort of being, I guess, bound by sort of the limitations of government, of white government over these councils. And it included a story, your front page story was actually talking about seawalls, which has been a continuing controversy in the Torres Strait, and particularly for the outer islands. I mean, I'm just wondering if you could explain where we're up to in relation to funding those seawalls on the outer islands like Boigu and Saibai.
Yeah, well, it was lobbying from the previous Labor government, which was then, the ball was picked up by the Abbott government, and a joint funding initiative of some $26 million equally between state and the feds was finally approved in November 2013. It was another year or so before local government got their ducks in a row and got the contractors' tenders signed and construction actually started. And now there's six communities which are predominantly suffering from coastal erosion and inundation from the sea, particularly at those king tides and low pressure systems.
Yeah.
We have a variety of different island styles. We have coral cays, which are just the sandbar islands, which are the most of risk. There's like Saibai and Boigu are more like a mudflat estuarine type island. And then we've got some volcanic islands in the east and the Torres Strait and Thursday Island, which obviously are hilly, so that they're less at risk. So that, out of those most of risk six island communities, Saibai and Boigu are the worst affected. Saibai probably being the most dire. The seawalls are well and truly under construction on Saibai, but there has been some discontent by Councillor Dimas Tovey on Boigu that they haven't started there either. And the rationale that the mayor of those outer island communities, Fred Giller, is saying that, well, we want to sign off on one island properly first, because there is going to be budget blowout for $26 million. It's not going to be enough. Then before they go back to the feds in the state with their handout for more money, Fred's told me that he wants to make sure that they can sign off and do a really good job on the worst affected community first and say, look, Look, this is the proof's in the pudding. We've done a good job on this one, but we need more money to continue doing the right job on each one, because his fear is if he starts all six islands simultaneously and runs out of money halfway through, you have a half-finished project which will just be eaten away by coastal inundation because it's not protected properly, and you're just throwing the baby out of the bathwater, so to speak, and you're back to square one and all that money's wasted. So he's very cautious about starting anything new until he's got one secure community locked down and knowing that community is properly catered for before moving on to the next one. So it is going to take some time. Saibai is expected to be for the rest of the year doing the seawall project, so it's unlikely that Boigu will start this year. It'll probably start next year, and so it is a multi-year project of getting it right. That said, the El Nino, which has pounded us with the lack of rain, has meant that the king tides have not been as bad because we haven't had the low pressure systems that bring those monsoonal rains over. So when the low pressure system makes the sea level, when you get a low pressure system, the sea level rises higher. So that in some ways has kept the coastal inundation slightly at bay this season, and it has also meant that more work could be done throughout the wet with concreting and so forth, which often, with the mud and the rain, excavators and concreting grinds to a halt. So it's been a blessing in that sense that there's been more work been able to be achieved because of the weather conditions.
But on the other side, as you were saying, that the El Nino conditions are really causing havoc, I guess, for a lot of island communities who might want to grow their own gardens or things like that. There must be a bit of urgency around that. Oh, drinking water.
Yeah, like Saibai, for example, has been down, their reservoir has been at 0%.
Oh, my God.
December, so they've had a couple of desalination units out there pumping water, and in fact, out of all the 15 communities, there's only one has enough water in the reservoir. The rest have less than 50%. Most of them have less than 30, and a few have none. So, and those reservoirs should be pretty healthily filled up by now. So that sort of gives an indication. And also, we've had through the Torres Strait Treaty Agreement, where people from PNG nationals are allowed to come over for traditional purposes, there has been an influx of them coming over to Saibai, especially, and Boigu to get drinking water, because they're suffering even worse over there, and their government is obviously doesn't have the funds or the will to support those people, and they're scraping the bottom of their wells and drinking dirty water and getting cholera. So there's been quite a few people coming over and putting a strain on the water supplies we've got here as well. So, it's a long way to go. And we've had a week of on and off rain, but it should have been 3 months of it by now.
And I can imagine you talk about the strain on services as well, but also just potential diseases coming into the Torres Strait as well. I can imagine from that influx of people who need help from PNG. Is that a concern or?
Well, especially the tuberculosis, the multi-drug resistant, and now the extreme multi-drug resistant strains of tuberculosis, which is the most prevalent in the world, just across the ditch there on the western province of PNG. And there's very little being done by the PNG government. There's been promises of funding to tackle that problem, of which only half has been allocated, the burdening spread of the disease is really straining the infrastructure there, which is pretty tired and relies heavily on Australian and international aid. And while tuberculosis is a disease of poverty, you're more likely to get it if you're malnutritioned and sick and run down and live in substandard sort of shelter, which fortunately most Torres Strait Islanders don't have that. And it is an ongoing concern. When we have had in the last couple of years a couple of deaths in those communities from tuberculosis of our citizens who have contracted the disease from PNG nationals. So that is an ongoing constant threat. Perceived threat. It's an ongoing continued concern. The numbers haven't of people contracting that disease hasn't actually been any worse this year than the previous, but, you know, it's something that we monitor pretty closely, you know, because Saibai is only 3Ks from Papua New Guinea, so it is an ongoing concern.
When you talk about the water, you know, El Nino conditions, how would you describe it at the moment? Would you describe it as sort of a crisis level at the moment? Or are things being done to sort of rectify it?
I mean, there's only so much you can do. There's Torres Strait Regional Island Council has put extra mobile desalination plants in those most at-risk communities, and they're working night and day to produce water. The desal units, most of those communities have a permanent desal unit anyway, and I've been told that due to the murkiness of the water, there's a lot of sediment in the water that's been stirred up by this El Nino apparently as well, and that's slowing down filtration as well, so it's a double whammy. I mean, also, we're suffering up here. The science has just come in last week that sea temperatures are way above normal up here because of the, you know, we just had the hottest February ever after last year, which was the hottest year ever, and it's hotter this year, and those water temperatures are up around 31, 32 degrees, so we're now facing 50% of our coral dying this season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so coral bleaching is, and that's not just through the Torres Strait. That's hit critical all throughout the Great Barrier Reef.
Yeah.
I mean, just anecdotally, you go for a swim up here and you jump in the water and it's hotter than you'd have at a spa. It's not refreshing. You know, you actually sweat swimming. It's you know, 32 degree temperature water is like a very warm bath.
Yeah.
The cray fishermen up here, which is the predominant fishery industry, have been having a really lousy season because they're saying the water is too hot. It's affecting crayfish stocks, and
right.
I don't know about the fin fishery, which is also another big fishery up here. I've been told anecdotally that the prawn fishery is also suffering. I haven't seen any science on that as of yet, but it is strange times that we're living in, and you know, climate change is something that people up here face every day when they get up and walk out the front door. There's nothing theoretical about it when you live in the Torres Strait. You know, you can see it and feel it every single day. It's like even just like my electricity bill in the last quarter was double what it usually is. We usually turn the air cons off at night and stuff up here because of the rains, but they've been going night and day to keep the place at 25 degrees and working a lot harder than usual because it is just so unseasonably warm right now. It hasn't abated since November, which is the height of the heat, and it's just stayed that way until now.
You must get a sense that you would just love to send the nation's politicians up to the Torres Strait to sort of... It's really hard to link individual weather patterns to climate change, but, I mean, I've read studies where it's, you know, which... It's starting to gradually link what's happening in the Torres Strait to global warming and climate change. You must just want to transport all the nation's politicians up to the Torres Strait just for a week to get them to understand what's actually happening.
Yeah, look, you know, the whole thing about you can't connect current climatic conditions to weather conditions to climate change. I mean, I understand the argument, but there was also some pretty good arguments that smoking didn't kill you for 30 years as well. And, you know, it's like, and there's always going to be an area of scientific error that people that don't want to believe this can call upon. But look, you know, I know there's some anomalies in the science, but you know, when you get reports, you know, like we have this week, I'm just looking through the current edition right now, and the Torres Strait Regional Authority, which is the federal peak body up here, gave us a story last week. And, water temperatures are close to coral breaching thresholds of the Torres Strait. 30.5 to 31.4 degree range, which is where coral bleaching starts.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Well, coral bleaching starts at 31, so we're having temperatures that are exceeding that right now in the water, they're outright saying that climate change, Joe Tavila, the chair of the TSRO, saying climate change has led to warmer global temperatures and warmer oceans exacerbated by the current El Nino, which is one of the strongest on record. So, I mean, you know, the science is in, the Indigenous rangers get out there on ground or in the sea country, and they stick their head in the water, and you know they're monitoring the dieback of coral. And and another report which came out by the CSIRO about the entire Barrier Reef is saying that the vast majority of scientists are very concerned about the state of the reef, and I mean, obviously that also has economic implications too. There's some 70,000 jobs, tourism jobs attached to the reef and fishery jobs.
Yeah.
So for those that only want to look at the economic numbers and not the scientific numbers, there's implications there as well. So I think that and that's something actually with the seawalls issue that Fred Gila said to me. He was getting nowhere for many years talking about how rising sea levels was eating away at his islands because there was a percentage of non-believers in the federal government. So he, in order to get that funding successfully approved, he reframed the question and said it was ageing, failing infrastructure that needed to be replaced.
Yeah, right.
That's how they got the approval for those seawalls. They took the climate change word out of there. But the bottom line is, you know, the sea levels are rising here and eating away at the edges of those communities, and that's the reason we're building these seawalls, you know, because things are changing. It hasn't been this bad before. But it was a matter of reframing the pitch to get the money, and it's got the same result, you know, that we're getting that infrastructure built.
Yeah.
But it was pitching it as decaying, failing infrastructure rather than environmental conditions. So, it's a tough one. Most Australians do believe in climate change, but not everybody. And there's probably people listening to this jumping up and down going, it's not proven. But look, you're welcome to come to the Torres Strait and come for a swim and see the absence of crayfish, which are usually in abundance, and stick a thermometer in the water and you can see it's, you know, when it's above 31, that's when coral dies, period. So it's pretty hard to argue with that.
I can imagine, I just find it, what you're saying about Fred Gila as well, it's such an indictment on our country that climate change is even seen as a political issue, that it could be seen as politically divisive when it's really a scientific issue. And as you said, it's part of the living experience of Torres Strait Islanders right now. And I think successive governments have always blamed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for their poverty. But when you look at the economic consequences of climate change, particularly to communities that largely have high unemployment numbers, you sort of think it's so destructive to so many communities just letting this go on and not paying attention to it. It's really, really concerning and horrific in my view.
Yeah, when you actually live in a community which is a lot more in the natural environment as opposed to living in a city where you can actually, the natural environment can be an abstract concept somewhat, you know, you've got climate control in your room and everything's at the supermarket. It's hard to ignore it, you know, and even if you don't believe in climate change, everyone's, you know, the people that don't necessarily believe it up here would still be saying, geez, it's hot, it's unseasonably hot, and it's weird there's been no wet season this year, and it's weird the water's so hot, and you know, it's like, so it's, you know.
I mean,
it's not just Torres Strait Islanders. I mean, it's a global situation. It's like, you know, right now we've got one of the mass, the biggest ice sheets in Antarctica breaking away from the continent of Antarctica. I read just recently that the Arctic has had a temperature increase of 16 degrees this year, which is massive. And basically, the runaway climate model is off the scale this year, which is beyond what the prediction models have had. So they're having to recalibrate a lot of those predictions just because of what's happening this year. And I mean that whether it's just a freak weather condition that which has been perpetuating for the last few years, or it is actually a sustained change in the climate. Either way, it's a worry.
Yeah, definitely. I hopefully will keep talking to you this about climate change, particularly how it affects the Torres Strait at a later date. But we're just going to take a break, and I wanted to come back and actually talk to another story that was in your paper recently, and it was about the visit from the Recognise campaign to Torres Strait.
Yeah, sure.
And I was interested in seeing what the feeling up there is like, because I know the feeling down here is very divisive. So we'll be back after the break.
Yep.
I'll keep you on the line. And here's a bit of Shelley Morris, If It Wasn't For You.
If you missed today's show or would like to hear Let's Talk again, catch the repeat from 7pm weekdays or listen via the podcast at 989fm.com.au. Here's Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning. Welcome back to Let's Talk, where we're getting an update from the Torres Strait from Torres News editor Aaron Smith. And another story that was making news up your way, Aaron, was a visit from the Recognise crew. So they're the sort of campaign, government-funded campaign designed to sort of drum up support for constitutional reform. And they're actually visiting Mer Island. Were they? Can you tell us a little bit about their visit?
They actually rather than the roads recognition, they did a boat trip to recognition. So they sailed to every one of those Torres Strait Island communities, and had community consultation about that process of changing the constitution. And I know you mentioned previously that it's been a divisive issue. I remember hearing about those 500 traditional owners in Melbourne, which unanimously turned down the prospect. From a personal point of view, I'm struggling to see why it's an issue. Some of the issues that were raised in the community consultation here is that there should be pursuit of treaty and not changing the constitution. But having spoken to the solicitors and Indigenous Australians involved in the Recognise campaign, as I understand it, having a treaty and changing the constitution do not have to be mutually exclusive. In fact, there's no reason why it should have no impact on different Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander nations pursuing their own treaty as other Indigenous people have around the world. As far as I understand it, it's just correcting an incredible wrong in the Constitution. There's racial elements and putting in some sort of mention of First Australians. I realise that it's largely symbolic, but in fact, I commented online and there was an article written by someone, a young woman whose name I've forgotten now, an article about telling dropping the F-bomb in the title of the article about why they shouldn't, what her thoughts were about the process and it should be treaty. And it's like, I don't get it, because from what I've been told and speaking to people about this who are pushing this movement, is that one doesn't kill the other. It's just correcting one part of many wrongs that need to be corrected. And I personally think that we would end up with both treaties or a treaty. I don't see how we could have one treaty if there's 150 plus Aboriginal nations across the country, but and a change to the constitution. And so you look at some of the issues that were raised in the meetings that I attended was that, and also the Torres Strait Treaty, which is an existing treaty, not between the Australian government and the Torres Strait Islanders, but rather between two sovereign states. It's a treaty between Australia and Papua New Guinea, which has been around for 30 years, and it allows free movement of traditional inhabitants for traditional purposes of fishing and ceremony between 13 villages in the western province of PNG and those outer island communities. With permission from both community leaders, people can go back and forth without a visa, and that was established to maintain traditional bonds between families which are split by a border that was formed some 40 years ago, with the independence of PNG. So it's and that was raised as like, what happens if we change the constitution? Does that impact that treaty, which we've formed with a different country? And the answer was a categorical no. Again, it's just about removing racial elements from the constitution, which is considered the highest legal document in white Australia, and also adding whether it's a preamble or some sort of recognition of the first Australians. Now, from that, people are saying, well, that's a cop-out and that'll be the end of it. We won't get treaty. But, I mean, in the Victorian courts right now, as I understand it, there is treaty negotiations underway, regardless of whether the Constitution changes or not. And so, yeah, you may be more abreast of this conversation than me, but that's, I'm perplexed about it. And it was definitely the talk of having a treaty independence of the constitution change didn't actually occur much up here. It did at one talk, but the other ones not as much. And so it doesn't seem as much of an issue up here as it has in other places. There is the division, but there seems to be, my feeling, a reasonable consensus between people here that we need to change the constitution. And especially on Murray Island, you know, that they were very receptive to the idea. And Murray Island is not one to shy away from an opinion. You know, that's the birthplace of native title, so you know, they're fully abreast of getting native issues to the forefront, front and centre, quite literally. They held court, the High Court was held on Murray Island in 1989 as part of that Mabo case. So you know, they don't shy away from a scrap. But yeah, look, we even had Cecilia and William Mabo up here. As figurehead representing Eddie Mabo, so don't know. you tell me. Correct me.
It's a very divisive issue down here. I personally believe that treaty won't happen if this continual push towards constitutional reform continues, largely because it does seem to be focused more on a preamble, and it largely seems to be just a push to get treaty off the table almost. There's sort of this political bipartisanship that hasn't let a lot of Aboriginal voices for real reform into the table. So I think it'll be interesting to see. But I think everyone's viewpoint is valid, particularly people in the Torres Strait. You know, they know what they want and they know what they want to push for. But I was wondering if there was any awareness prior to this visit around the debate around constitutional reform, because I think it's one of the biggest debates we're having down here.
But
was there awareness before?
Yeah, not so much. No, I mean, those articles in the Constitution, you know, I think that before the Recognise campaign was pretty much unknown. I mean, that said, you know, we have a parade for the 67 referendum date for Mabo Day. That is a holiday up here, and so that you know, those landmarks are celebrated, you know, and recognised, but. This particular one is a new one to the table.
Yeah.
So you think that if this is signed off on, it's a symbolic gesture that, and all the other issues will be forgotten about because we've done that, that's done and done.
And particularly I just wonder, because I think the question is, for one, it's been going on for about 5 or 6 years now, and they've never put up a model, and there was an expert panel report. Neither Labor or Liberal have ever fully responded to the recommendations of that report, and it largely seems to be focused on doing something meaningless, taking that to referendum where white Australia, not Aboriginal Australia, actually vote on those sort of things, and largely it's going to be a preamble that will likely be significantly watered down. So I think it's a really controversial issue, and I'm interested in the way that the Recognise campaign have been trying to raise awareness of what they've been telling people exactly, or how they get people into the debate. I think that's an interesting story in itself. So I'm really, really glad and to hear your opinion of it and what you think actually went down in the consultations as well. But I think it's just a really controversial debate as well. It'll be interesting.
Is there a concern that is the model that you'd prefer to see
no
a treaty or a series of treaties?
I think a treaty would be better because I understand that argument that, you know, they can both happen at the same time, or they can both happen, you know, irrespective of each other. But I actually think, politically speaking, once you get the referendum out of the way, and I mean, referendums are very hard to pass as well in Australia, so I just wonder what would happen to a no vote as well. I just think the push towards treaty, which is actually just, you know, sort of raising more awareness now around the importance of treaty, I think that would be significantly diminished by a referendum, particularly if there's a no vote around something like a preamble, which would just be largely fluffy and meaningless. And what you need is the removal of the race power, which governments don't seem to be very interested in doing. I mean, no political leaders have come out in support of removing the race power, really, from Labor or Liberal. So I think it's a really sad debate that sort of turned attention away from treaty, but then treaty is a very controversial issue as well. What would it look like? What would it lead to? You know, what would each individual nation want? So I think
I was wondering, would it be each individual nation or groups of nations, you know, want to apply for their own treaty? Like, as I understand it, there's something going through the courts right now in Victoria, is there not?
Yeah, well, that's true. And I think the interesting thing is a lot of Aboriginal leaders right now are talking about mechanisms to set up those discussions around treaty. For example, an Aboriginal lawyer down in Sydney from Queensland actually is actually talking about assemblies of First Nations and mechanisms to actually lead for a pathway towards deciding that.
Yeah.
So I think it's something we need to talk about, and I'm not sure that the Recognise campaign is interested in discussing treaty or things other people might want to discuss. So a very controversial issue around the country, it seems, even in the Torres Strait, maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, being a white guy, being of the 97% that's not Indigenous, I see the current constitution as a blight on our nation.
Racist. I mean, it's the only country we're the only country in the world that has a racist constitution, which is amazing.
So. And we're the only Commonwealth country that doesn't have a treaty. So, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that they both should occur. You'd have to agree that the constitution has to be changed. We can't have those racist elements in it. Would you not? Or?
Yeah, and I think a lot of Aboriginal leaders have called on constitutional reform as well, but largely, I think we need the road to treaty to begin. And it's largely the process that has happened around constitutional reform in the current way it's been carried out as well over the past 6 years. I don't think we're ready as a country to even begin dealing with it. And if you look overseas at places like South Africa who reformed their constitution, but it was largely after apartheid and those laws were taken away. And you look at their constitution and it's amazing because it comes after all these things happen, whereas we as a nation are still deeply racist. And I'm saying South Africa is still racist as well, but we haven't even had that reckoning of what happened from invasion. We haven't even begun to discuss that. And I think that's what a treaty would do. It would start talking about the unfinished business. And I don't think the unfinished business is going to be resolved through constitutional reform, which is ultimately a white man's document. It's Australia's founding document. So I think we need to start talking about treaty first. That's why I believe in treaty more so than constitutional reform. And I think, the road towards treaty would be significantly diminished if we had a failed referendum and a failed constitutional reform process.
Oh, I agree. For me, the thought of a failed referendum is unthinkable. You know, it would send us back to it would send us back 100 years. And I'm a strong believer in both. And I get perplexed that there's two camps forming, because I mean maybe I'm just being naive and idealistic that the mainstream, you know, we live in a multicultural society now, of which the first Australians are a very small minority, and so the political clout of them is reduced by just the numbers. So the way to bring about real change is to get the mainstream population to see the wrongdoings and to recognise and have, you know, I mean, closing the gap is to me more important than either of these two issues, because it's, you know, it's the real things on the ground which the failing of the closing the gap, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a failure in itself, closing the gap.
Oh, it's a total failure, and you know, a lot of the policies that have been implemented, you know, from the top down, and there needs to be more self-determination, room for self-determination and so forth. But I just think that, I mean, like, I've heard criticism about the apology being symbolic, but which is all true and fair criticism. But it's still things that, you know, it's better that it happened than it didn't. You know, that, you know, if some things are not palatable for mainstream Australia, being a pragmatist as well, thinking, well, maybe let's get across the line what is palatable and then work on the other things later, and rather than not getting anything at all. I guess that's the way I see that the Recognise campaign. It's like it's far from perfect. I understand concerns that it will somewhat blackwash or whitewash, whatever way you look at it, the issues of the racial disharmony in this country. But for me, it's like better to chip away at a block than try to smash it in one hit, because, you know, the older I get, the more I realise that the harder you hit your head against the brick wall doesn't necessarily bring it down.
And it's something I think it's important we have these discussions anyway. I think that's the important thing. We have to start talking about what we'd like, and actually thrash out all of the issues as they are. And I think, feel we could have talked another hour about this, but we're actually closing at the end of our program. But I feel we could have talked for another hour about Recognise.
Yeah,
but,
totally.
I mean, that's for another day.
The conversation
day.
Has to continue, and I think that Recognise has failed in some degrees in making that a whole conversation, and now the treaty thing is coming out now, as far as, you know, as I'm concerned, even though I live in an Indigenous community, and I still don't have my head around it,
and we might have to end the program there. Sorry about that. We're into the news.
Okay, thank you. See you later.
98.9 FM News.
Earlier, this is Stephen Clark with the National.